never dream that my four little children one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
U.S. forces, give the nod. It's a setback for your cause.
I'm talking about the real owners now. The big, wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. Politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back. So they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
Your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end. Those are rich men. Those are rich men.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor General.
God save the Queen! The fascist regime!
Boxing is nothing like going to war with machine guns, bazookas, hand grenades, bomber airplanes. My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, and continue killing innocent people.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side?
I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet, I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction. And all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
There are many whites who are trying to solve the problem, but you never see them going under the label of liberals. That white person that you see calling himself a liberal is the most dangerous thing in the entire Western Hemisphere. He's the most deceitful. He's like a fox, and a fox is always more dangerous in the forest than the wolf. You can see the wolf coming. You know what he's up to. But the fox will fool you. He comes at you with his mouth shaped in such a way that even though you see his teeth, you think he's smiling and taking for a friend.
I can no longer remain in today's Democratic Party that's under the complete control of an elitist cabal of warmongers who are driven by cowardly wokeness.
And that's why psychos run the world. Because they don't give a fuck. They don't feel guilt. They don't give a shit. They'll fucking kill anybody. You know, and nice people, we should be killing them, but we don't because we can't deal with the guilt, right? And what do psychos do? They stay in power by killing loud, nice people. Martin Luther King, loud, nice. I know he banged a bunch of broads. Who gives a fuck? Guy was fucking up there crushing it. If nice people start killing psychos, okay, maybe then you wouldn't have a swirl of trash the size of Texas in the middle of the fucking Pacific Ocean. Do we work on that now? Because there's psychos in the world, and all they end up doing is trying to keep improving golf equipment so these man-titted fucking cunts can keep a ball on the fairway.
I punched him dead in his eyes.
Who are you crawling in the pitch?
I guess I fell so deep in love, I grew dependency. I was too blind to see just how it was affecting me. All that I knew is you was all the man I had. And I was scared to let you go, even though you treated me bad. But I don't wanna see my kids see me getting beat down by daddy smacking mommy all around. You say I'm nothing without you, but I'm nothing with you. A man don't really love you if he hits you. Yeah. This is my notice of the tool, I'm not taking it no more. I'm not your personal whore, that's not what I'm here for. Ain't nothing good gon' come to you, till you do right by me. Brother, you wait.
Who you calling a bitch?
Yes, welcome to System Failure, episode number 2, and we're joined by a very special guest host who's going to be joining us on as many episodes as he can make, coming down the chute. That's Dave Rastovich, mate.
The chute. I like it. Yeah, man, thanks for including me, and actually it's just me dorking out on you and this whole offshoot of what you guys do, and that all came from listening to that epic intro. I fucking love that intro and that whole collage montage or whatever it's called of just really inspirational audio. And it got me fired up, and then actually just listening to some of the things you've been reporting on, specifically the Palestinian and Israeli situation, and that discussion there was really admirable. And I just was like, you know what, I'd love to have anything to do with this kind of work where, you know, we have the opportunity to speak with really lit up people and help proliferate their work and their just their abilities as well. Like, you know, any opportunity to upskill ourselves and share the toolkit is just rad. And I really, really psych on that when it's like, actually, I'm going to listen to something, or I'm going to read something, or I'm going to hang out and have a cup of tea with someone. And at the end of it, hopefully I've given them something useful, and hopefully I have received something useful from them. And that's what I get from, yeah, your intention with this whole systems failure thing.
Yeah, that's it, man. Exactly. It's really all about pooling our resources, pooling our networks, pooling our influence, pulling in all the great minds that we can, and the practical applications to push back on the scum and the Nazis and the fascists and the skull fucking corporate reptiles. We're gonna have a solid crack at them all, because at the end of the day, no one else is gonna do it, are they, Dave?
No, perhaps not. Well, they are. There is actually there's many people doing it.
There's many people doing
it. Not in this way. Yeah.
Exactly. And I guess you know, we're coming at it, for me personally, I'm coming at it from the John Pilger, Julian Assange school of no holds barred truth telling. So yeah, buckle up.
Yeah, and I'm psyched on the idea of us to also going to these issues firsthand. You know, I can see in our immediate future being in some old growth somewhere and speaking with the people who give so much of a shit and have such a connection to those places that they're willing to be there, living uncomfortably. They're willing to be put in harm's way. You know, they're willing to be, you know, shredded by the mozzies, shredded by the other humans, shredded by society for making those decisions. But there's a really interesting story to tell there, and there's really admirable, honorable work being done by people all over the country, all over the world. And I actually really love that idea of meeting those people and looking in their eye and feeling that fire in them. You know, it's contagious.
Mate, 100%. And they need all the support and encouragement we can get them. And, you know, it's not just going to be those people chained, locked onto trees or machinery or whatever. We're going to be giving you, the ordinary working person, really practical ways in which you can push back on the horseshit for the sake of your children and your community and all the things that you love in this world. Because, you know, look, let's be real, they're here to fucking take it all, aren't they? That's what it seems like. Poison our oceans, poison our rivers, burn our forests, poison our forests, take our time, take our money, you know, just load us up with microplastics and PFAS, destroy fertility rates, make our dicks small. It's fucking never ending. So it's time to push back on the horse shit.
I'm hearing that. Yes.
We're ripping in.
I hear that loud and clear. Especially the small dick thing. Yeah, I don't have enough to afford to lose. I'm tall and I'm skinny, and I know what that sort of reputation is meant to have and everything, but I'm, you know, I'm 2D. I'm shaped like a piece of paper. I turn sideways, I disappear. There's not that much of me. I can't afford to lose any more than I have.
Mate, I'm right there with you.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm pretty lanky, actually.
Yeah, let's fucking blame it on the microplastics, fucking dogs. But, mate, today we had a chat with Jess from the WA Forest Alliance, and what a brain she was. This was an amazing chat, and it put a rocket right up me, and I learned a lot. I mean, this is not really my place of expertise, but that's what we're here to do, is to learn from people who know better than us, learn with humility and have a fucking crack.
Yeah, I actually really appreciated her her specifics in terms of looking at the deforestation issue and thinking, oh, you either got to choose between having just, you know, wild bush that just sits there and just sits there, or an industry that looks at it as a resource and creates a few jobs, creates a bit of coin for a select few people, and then they destroy the place forever. I liked that she zoomed in, and the work of her whole crew zoomed in and go, actually, there's like this, not so much a middle ground, but there's something in between the two polarities of just like us and them, good and bad, leave it alone, do nothing, or just take it all sort of mentality, extremism.
Mm.
And when she was speaking about the whole idea of working with farmers, working with agricultural individuals and communities and companies to replant and to bring back biodiversity in places on those farmlands near to creeks, near to rivers that are kind of like plantations but a new type of plantation. Mm. You know, what we're used to, what we've all grown up with around the country, you drive through pine plantations, there's nothing there. It's a monoculture nuked space, and that's not the plantation of the future. The plantation of the future has to have some sort of mirroring of the way life thrives on this planet, which is diversity. And I liked that she was talking about that their work is incorporating that. It's not just that kind of black and white us and them, do everything to a place or leave a place completely alone kind of attitude. I don't know if you got that from what she was saying, but to me, that's something that really stuck with me. I reckon it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. She had such a, you know, both a microscopic and macroscopic understanding of this problem. And, you know, she wasn't one of those pinko lefties with her head in the sand, oblivious about the debt pressures and the you know, financial situation that so many workers in these industries, whether it be timber or mining, are up against. Mm. So, yeah, a great chat. And, yeah, let's hand it over to her. Mm. All right, Jess, welcome to System Failure. Yeah, you're a representative of the WA Forest Alliance. Can you tell us a bit about this organisation?
Yeah, sure can. So we're the peak forest conservation group in WA. We represent 27 other forest conservation groups, including Wilderness Society and Conservation Council, so a couple of big groups who otherwise do a lot of other climate and nature-related work across the state, but we represent them on forests. And then we're another 25 groups, small and large environment and forest conservation groups right across the southwest. We've been around since 1990, and until recently our major focus has been on ending native forest logging, but obviously there's a whole bunch of other threats that face the southwest forest as well that that we're across and increasingly focused on.
Yeah, can you tell us about some of the campaigns that you're involved in that are ongoing right now and some of the threats?
There's so many. What we're doing is focusing on the ones that we feel are the most significant, that we most need to make change on, and that we think that we can make a change on. So the ones that we have on our radar right up the top of our priorities are ending native forest mining expansions, which is a particular problem down here with bauxite mining, and also applications for lithium and other mining that are kicking off right across the forest areas. We're also really concerned about the way that forests and other ecosystems down here are being burnt deliberately to reduce fire risk, but there's all sorts of problems associated with that. As native forest logging comes to a close at the end of this year officially, we're looking at how we actually transition into that new place and make sure that we're getting the best possible protections for the forest in secure national parks that have got the right boundaries and are being managed as best as possible and in strong relationships with the Noongar traditional owners down here, and also that we don't end up with a thinning program that actually just develops into the new logging. So we've got kind of four major program areas that we're focused on, and making good progress on all four.
Unreal. And what are some of the forces that you're up against in your fight?
Well, climate change is probably the most complicated nebulous one, but then the ones that we really know that we can make tangible changes to with policy right now. Of course, there's all sorts we can do to mitigate and adapt to climate change as well, but the ones that are kind of in government's immediate remit to deal with to protect forests better now, it's the ongoing pressure from the timber industry to continue access for timber, and then major mining companies, and also a kind of a fear mentality that underpins the way that prescribed burning is being done, that really doesn't look properly at the science or the long-term ecological consequences. It's just a really knee-jerk, short-sighted, often not very scientific approach. I think those three are probably the big things that we're up against.
All right. Yeah, well, let's start with timber for a start, because, you know, it's a big issue, not just in West Oz, but around the country. You know, can you give us an idea, just for the layman out there, like, you know, what is this timber used for example?
Well, the vast majority, WA and around Australia, is very, very low-value product. So, first of all, only about 50% of the wood is actually taken out of the forest. The rest is left behind and burnt because it's not considered merchantable. It's too difficult to remove and they can't be bothered. So, we, you know, huge amounts of wood are just left behind on the floor and burnt. But what is removed, 85% of that is becoming wood chip, firewood, charcoal, sawdust in WA, and very similar stats around the rest of the country. Only about 15% is ending up at a sawmill and being made into anything useful that's, you know, going to be beautiful and useful for us, and also continue to store its carbon into the future.
And what would be the alternatives?
So many good alternatives. We've already got more than 90% of Australia's timber is already coming from plantations, so it's not complicated to shift over entirely to plantations. But we don't only want to see fence-to-fence, you know, blue gum or softwood plantations. We also want to see a strategic and clever hardwood farm forestry approach, so that you're introducing timber onto farms. So you're not competing with agriculture. You're actually supporting and augmenting agriculture by having really good quality tree lots that you've integrated into those systems, and that's the hardwood stuff that you know, then you get that really good feature grade, furniture grade stuff out of the hardwood plantations. You know, quite often people say, well, what are the alternatives if we stop? And then they say that we're going to be ending up importing more timber from overseas, but that's just completely unnecessary. The other argument there, of course, is that, you know, some mythical set of circumstances in which what we're doing in Australia is better and less impactful than what's happening overseas. But of course, that's just nonsense, because the impacts that we're seeing to forests here and how biodiverse they are, and, you know, the fact that we've lost more mammals than any other country on earth, shows that what we're doing here internationally is really significant as well.
Jess, can you speak to that dynamic between you all and the farmers, and industry and the farmers, in relation to planting out hardwood in locations, like you were saying, that aren't going to be making a real struggle for farmers or in competition with agriculture, like you were saying? Could you please speak to that a little bit more, please?
Yeah, we developed a proposal called Forest for Life in 2016, and it's just starting to get legs again now. There's a lot of catchment councils and NRM groups in the southwest of WA who are really keen to see it progress. We initially developed it as a transition strategy for getting out of native forest logging, and I've lived down in the southwest for a long time and been in timber town, so I've got quite a close relationship and understanding about the need to, you know, what just transition really means, about having real quality of work, and also the transition of skills. So you're not asking timber workers to become, you know, baristas or massage therapists or run tourism operations, which is obviously just really offensive and random and isn't going to get legs. So instead what we did was say, how are we going to create as many or more new jobs in the timber industry, transferable skills in exactly the right locations? And what we came up with was this Forest for Life plan, which would create two zones of plantings, both 20,000 hectares each, so 40,000 hectares altogether, in the areas where there was already a very active timber industry, and at the same time be doing a fair amount, so 10% target of that 4,000 hectares of permanent reveg. So I was sort of imagining, you know, pulling your lens right back and looking at the landscape at a catchment by catchment level and thinking, what could we be doing while we're developing better timber and looking after timber industry workers? What can we also be doing to be significantly improving water quality and having a landscape level land care benefit? So we developed this program catchment by catchment to say, if we plant this many trees on these different paddocks and then also do this permanent re-veg on these creeks and get a number of farmers to all participate, you start to see this sort of patchwork develop across the landscape, and then all sorts of benefits for biodiversity and water and salinity and erosion, while you're also introducing new and sustainable timber into the right locations. So you asked the question about, you know, how do you interact with farmers and make that a cooperative rather than a competitive business, and that was about saying, well, you know, plantations are that fence-to-fence plantation modality that we so often see does operate in competition with agriculture. But when you go and you talk to the farmer and you know, down to the very level of how wide are your machines and what are you running, what crop, what stock are you running, how do we introduce trees in such a way that you won't lose any of that productivity, but you're going to get longer cropping times, you're going to get better shelter for the sheep, you know, all those things that has been really well done in the past around the country, but really upscaling it so that we can see those significant benefits right across the landscape.
Wow, fantastic.
And what's being lost by the timber industry as a result of the timber industry, as a result of bodgy backburns? You know, what are we losing out there that people may not be aware of?
It's pretty devastating, and it doesn't matter which state you look at. If it's Tassie, New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, WA, you know, the forests that we've got here grow nowhere else in the world. They're some of the most carbon-dense forests in the world, so they're storing and also continuing to draw down huge volumes of carbon from the atmosphere. They're also some of the most biodiverse forests on the planet. Here in WA, we've got so many plant and animal species that exist nowhere else. And it's because, you know, we're separated on the east side by all that desert and on the west side by all that ocean. We've got very poor, nutrient-poor soils, very old soils. So the animals and plants that have developed here have developed in these really particular circumstances. So, you know, we've got little dudes down here, numbats and phascagales and western ringtail possums, all sorts of cockatoos, birds and mammals, myriad species that you just don't find anywhere else. And we've been seeing 10 football fields of that forest being logged or cleared every single day here in the southwest for the last several years. And we don't even know what a lot of the losses are that we're incurring because so little of it has been studied. But, you know, we do know that these magnificent ancient forests that take hundreds of years to develop the very old trees and thousands of years to develop that complex ecology, once they're gone, they're just irreplaceable.
Wow. If you're a local down that part of the country, how do you gain a first-hand experience of that 10 football field a day level of clearing? Is it hard to get through the beauty strips that are often planted out along road edges and things and get through to see these locations? How are people going to see that level of clearing and have that firsthand experience that can motivate you to become such a champion for your local forests?
Yeah, the beauty strips, hey, they're a very cleverly used maneuver in WA and around the country, sometimes about 200 metres, sometimes less, depending on how well used the road is. But, you know, it's not hard. You just turn off the highway anywhere. And in WA and Victoria, at the end of the year, thankfully, we're seeing an end to this intensive commercial logging that we've seen for such a long time. But so you hopefully won't be still seeing bulldozers actually operating, but you'll see the aftermath and the difference between those really old ecosystems with the big old trees and the young ones and the open understory and that incredible diversity of an old forest compared to what's left afterwards with even age plantings, often of just one species and, you know, so depleted. No, it's not difficult to see. And the other thing people can see here in WA is when you fly from Perth down to Albany on the little 33-seater that takes about an hour from the, you know, metro down to the south coast, you fly over all the bauxite mining and that's just so in your face. It's strip mining that's just going for kilometres and kilometres out into the distance, including right up to the edge of our drinking water dams. So it's a pretty horrific sight from the air.
Right. Is the bauxite mining, is that Alcoa? Is that the corporation that's involved in that?
Yeah, Alcoa is the biggest player. They've got a state agreement act and a mineral lease that goes all the way from Perth to Collie. It takes about 2.5 hours to drive that distance. And their mineral lease they've had since the 1960s, it's absolutely enormous. And then South 32 is the other major company. Their bauxite mine lease area is on the eastern edge of that, on a fair bit of private land, but also a lot of forest. And between those two companies, they've cleared over 30,000 hectares of the forest since the 1960s. And they've both got massive expansion proposals up for approval at the moment that we're fighting very hard to limit and reduce the impacts of.
Wow, yeah. How good's that? Alcoa, a Pittsburgh-based Aluminium Corporation with some Henry Kissinger era foreign policy. And so I understand that, what was it, February this year, that they were exposed as having piped, was it PFAS or something into a drinking water dam? Can you talk us through some of the things they've been guilty of during their tenure?
Yeah, it's been a very bad year for them being exposed in all of these things, and there's a lot of articles that people can access on our website if they want to have a look more deeply into it. There's been one particular journalist from WA Today called Peter Milne who's won a couple of awards for all the investigative journalism, and it's really shining a spotlight on how bad the toxic legacy is that this company is leaving, particularly here in WA. But then, you know, you zoom the lens out and see what's happening in the 10 other countries they're operating in, and it's pretty savage. So the main things that have been highlighted are that, yep, they built a pipeline over a drinking water dam to transport PFAS, the forever chemical, the most toxic and long-lasting chemical that we know of, without approval from the Water Corporation. So they'd asked for approval to build the pipeline, it got on with building it without waiting for anybody to get back to them, and then they were busted for having done that, and they had to clean it out, and they're coming up with another proposal now for how they're going to deal with that. But they've got two mine sites that are considered to be contaminated sites because of all the PFAS and hydrochemicals and other things that have been leaching into the ground there. All sorts of other things. I mean, they haven't successfully rehabilitated one single hectare of land to government standards. And they've still got about 5,500 hectares sitting completely bare. And just last week there was another caustic spill, chemical spill at one of their refineries. This is the third one in 3 or 4 years that have had serious impacts on workers. And, you know, things that are just obvious and should be getting addressed, management and monitoring that should be happening to look after workers that just isn't happening. And you know, the story here is the same as it is around the world. It's, yeah, it's about time that they were exposed because their activities have been pretty shocking.
And I understand, like many unscrupulous corporations, they're involved in a bit of manipulative greenwashing. Can you detail what's been going on there?
Oh, well, it's pretty sad, really. I mean, they funnel money all over the place. They sponsor the Bibbulmun Track and the Mundubidi, so our two best trails, walking and riding through the forests here. They sponsor all sorts of organisations who are doing excellent work in other regards, but makes it more difficult for them to speak out on this issue, which is really sad for the people who work there, but also for the, you know, good work that they could be doing. They sponsor the Western Shield program, which is the department's Department of Biodiversity Conservation Attraction, so the government agency that's meant to be responsible for looking after biodiversity. Feral animals program is funded by Alcoa instead of by the government, which is just
that's a classic, isn't it, when the unscrupulous corporations sponsor government departments that are meant to be keeping checks and balances on them. It's a real classic, that one.
Isn't it? And we've just produced this series called the Toxic Legacy Series, looking at what's been going on around the world. And it's the same in all the other countries. There was 120 international organisations who stood up against a massive industrialisation of this incredible wilderness area in Iceland, where Alcoa wanted to move a bunch of their operations from the States to Iceland to cut costs. And it was going to involve damming a whole lot of incredible old rivers and messing up feeding grounds for a whole lot of different species. And initially the environment minister said very clearly that was going to be unacceptable, and about 2 months later changed their mind. And, you know, we don't know what went on in the background there, but they are well known for manipulation and getting their own way.
Jess, it sounds like there's just atrocious behaviour happening all over the planet from these people. But what about on the ground when we're looking at these rural communities, semi-remote communities down south WA, what's your angle on the alternative sources of income, the alternative career options people have in those places? How many people are actually employed by these beasts, and what are the other options?
Yeah, well, we're just starting to look at that a lot more seriously now. You know, as I described with the Forest for Life plan, it's really important to us that we're very sophisticated and nuanced in how we develop these transition proposals. It's really important that it's done well and that there's good, strong justice in there for the individuals and the communities and their families. We haven't done nearly as much work on this as we had done on the timber industry. As I'm sure you can imagine, it takes a really long time, not just from your own perspective, but also to engage meaningfully with people in those communities. So we're just at the beginning of that. But to answer your question, there's about 4,000 people employed by Alcoa. There's three refineries spread across the Northern Jarrow Forest region, the Darling Range. And then, with a lot of workers at the refineries and then also others out in the bush. 4,000 obviously is a lot of individuals, but it's not a lot of people proportionally speaking. And there are a lot of other sectors across the southwest, but I think our job and the job of unions and the state government is to think about transferable skills and quality work, not just random proposals to shift people, and that's something that we're starting to take seriously now.
Yeah, far out. So, and just to go back to the timber industry, I mean, look, it's no joke. In this country, it generates $24 billion annually. 80,000 people are employed by it. I guess the question is again, just like, how do we protect those people with mortgages and families to raise who depend on this industry, these industries, whether it be bauxite mining or logging, like how do we protect these people? And is there, is there bigger issues underpinning these problems? Like how much of what we're talking about here is the result of this kind of insatiable consumer culture, planned obsolescence, general wastefulness?
Yeah, look, in the first instance, those figures that you're quoting are for the timber industry across the board. So that's and the vast, vast majority is in plantation, not in native logging. And if you look at the books of any of the state logging agencies, so that, Sustainable Timbers Tasmania, Vic Forest, Forest Products Commission in WA, they all make a significant loss. Vic Forest just posted, I think it was a $60 million loss in the last financial year. Forest Products Commission was over 30. So it's not by any means, when you're looking at native forest logging, it's not by any means financially a benefit to the state. It's actually being heavily subsidised. And the numbers of workers have been falling off a cliff for many, many years, whereas the plantation sector is profitable and continues to increase in profitability and numbers of employees. So I think, in the first case, you need to separate those two things out.
Yep.
Also, native forest logging undermines the plantation sector because it's subsidised by the government and the timber is sold so cheap. So as we take native forest logging out of the picture, which is happening in WA and Victoria and hopefully the other states very soon, you start to see benefits financially and also in terms of employment and sustainability for the plantation sector. So, that needs to be done. But then if we look more broadly at your question, there's a bunch of industries that we have running in Australia, around the world, that are demonstrably unsustainable and they're not good for anybody, in the long term. And we need to be looking at ways that we can transition those industries so that, like the fossil fuel sector, for example, that sure, there's a lot of people employed there. There's a lot of money being pumped into the community and into the economy by those companies, but we're going to cook the planet if we keep going down that path. So we need to be more strategic and more intelligent and more willing to look into the long term and get in front of these policy problems with a bit more courage and intelligence than just saying, which I'm not suggesting for a second you're saying, but, this is what's levelled at us from industry and from government quite often. Oh, well, it's just a clash between the environment and the job, so it's a wicked problem. We can't do anything about it. We're well past that, I think, and we need to start coming up with some much cleverer solutions.
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with corporations and sometimes individuals who are sitting on more money than they could possibly spend in several lifetimes. So lack of financial resources is not an issue. I mean, we're entering the realm of universal basic incomes, a period in which automation is consuming so many jobs. The idea that we saw it in COVID, like there is the potential to simply subsidize those who've lost work, give them money that's, I guess, shaken down, for lack of a better term, from these corporations and redistributed amongst the public. Like it just seems like, it's a bit of a fallacy that there's not enough money to protect these workers. Yeah, maybe they do lose jobs and we do lose industries, but there's enough financial resources there to allow those people to still live happy, dignified, comfortable lives and put their energy and time elsewhere, whether it's fishing, growing food, raising a family, whatever. But that seems to me to be the juncture in history we've reached. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, that COVID was particularly, in those first few months in the first year or so, or if you're unlucky enough to be in Melbourne for those whole 2 years of all those lockdowns, it was pretty savage on people. But it did show us something very important, which is that when we collectively face a crisis, we can respond to it very quickly and very effectively to take care of the whole community and to look very holistically at the problem and then make personal individual sacrifices, in order to achieve something that is so important and up in our faces. And we need to be turning that same capacity to the climate and biodiversity crises that we're facing. It's not a financial hurdle, it's a political one. And we know that the hold that those major corporations have over both Liberal and Labor governments is actually the obstacle that is in front of us. And, of course, we can point at those individuals and those corporations and those political parties and be angry about that, and fair enough. But I think we also just need to look at our own individual capacity and capacity within our communities. And think, well, what can we do to turn that around? And there's so much despondency, and maybe that's gotten worse even since COVID. I think it's people's lack of hope, lack of faith, lack of willingness to have a go that is another major obstacle that we have in front of us. And that's where I see us all as individuals having a real role to play, is in doing something that we know we can do and doing it bloody well and working bloody hard, and then also trying to inspire people around us to pick something that they love, that they're really passionate about, and take it seriously and make it into your purpose.
Wow, beautifully put.
It is beautifully put. And you're right, a lack of hope and a lack of faith is one of the major hurdles we have to overcome. But so too for working class people is just having the time to invest and the energy to invest in standing up and pushing back on situations like this. I mean, the system, as far as I can tell, is designed to rob working people of either their time or their money. They're basically the same thing in capitalism, and it really nullifies any attempt to push back against these big corporations in any kind of, seems to me, meaningful way. It's hard, the old-fashioned protest, strike action, it's just not within a lot of people's means to participate in that kind of action anymore. What can the average worker who's up to his neck in mortgage debt, who's got a family to raise, who's in a cost of living crisis already, what is your advice to him or her?
Well, I think there's two things in that. First of all, those of us who are comfortable enough to be having these sorts of conversations need to be thinking about the intersectionality of all these things, because you're exactly right. There's a social justice component to capitalism, to climate change, to colonization, all of these things. It is our responsibility to be factoring in those social justice considerations in these other policy areas that we're thinking about. And then I think it's about coming down to your own level of your experience and your community. And the reason I say that is I'm thinking about the stats that came out from the referendum very recently of the number of people who voted yes compared to their involvement in a community group of one kind or another. So it was, you know, church groups and unions and firefighter clubs, you know, whatever it might be that they're a part of. People who are a part of a group were far more likely to vote yes. And I think that voting yes is says something about your hopefulness. It says something about how likely you are to believe that change is better than not change. And that's one of the symptoms, isn't it, of whether or not you can see a future and you're going to continue to hold on to some hope. And so finding that local connection, whatever it is, you know, joining your union is an excellent thing to do.
Love that. Yeah.
You know, and wherever you are in the world, somewhere that you love, whether it's walking along a river or, you know, you've got a bit of ocean that you love going down to or a bit of forest or whatever it is, it's somewhere in your community that you love being, just learning a bit more about it, thinking about who else is looking after that place, finding some people who you can collaborate with, and just doing some research, making yourself, getting yourself interested in the topics that you already have a draw towards. And I think that's our way in. It doesn't have to be big and fancy. It's just something that you love, that you're passionate about, and a connection that you can make locally, and that's the seed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more there. And I think as a response to the broad and vague terms that we hear when we're thinking of climate change and big global stories, I feel personally, and I see in my community around me, a real sense of hope and empowerment when we localize our vision for what we can actually do. And so that makes me curious, Jess, if you are someone who lives on the west side of this beautiful land and are facing that amazing Indian Ocean and you want to travel down south, where specifically can you look at those amazing forests still intact and at places that have been devastated by these industrial practices? And who specifically can you seek out who are caring for that country and back them up?
Oh, good on you. Thanks. So I would start by looking on Google Earth at dwelling up in Jarrahdale and just seeing how big that scar is that's been left by Alcoa, and then you follow it down towards the south and the east out to Boddington and Quindanning, and you see the scar that's been left by South 32, and you know that that is just growing all the time. There's a website called Walk GPS that's run by some incredible people. They've got a time lapse on there that shows that forest just being eaten away by those bauxite mining companies over the last few decades. It's shocking, and it's important for people to be aware of. And then you drive into Dwelling Up. You go to the Lost Eden Gallery, which is a beautiful place run by Monique Tippett, who's an incredible local artist, and see the work that she's got up on the walls, and talk to her and the people around her, and then drive out through Nanga Brook into some of the most beautiful old-growth Jarrah forests around there. And unfortunately, if you keep going, you'll come into a mine site as well. So that's where you start, very close to Perth, only an hour out of town. And then if you want to see into the deep south, into the forests that haven't been mined, but we've managed to stop logging in, and toward as soon as the end of the year comes a full end to commercial logging for timber, then you come down to Walpole in Denmark and you walk through the Tingle Forest and the Carey Forest, also around Pemberton. Absolutely stunning places. If you go to tourist bureaus in and tourist information centres in those towns, they've got great maps and information about forests that you can go to see those really good old growth places that we've still got down here. And then, of course, I'd recommend people follow us on socials and sign up through our website. That's WA Forest Alliance. And there's also another great group called Jarrahdale Forest Protectors who've got a self-drive tour map that you can download off their website. It takes you all through the Jarrah forests further north that I was talking about initially. And then, look, if your interest is more about oceans and rivers, then there's all sorts of other excellent groups and individuals on this side, but because I'm a forest lover, I'd suggest starting with the starting inland with the forests.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful,
amazing, mate. And you mentioned before the damage done to the wilderness due to botched backburning operations. I think one of them destroyed around 25,000 hectares of wilderness around Walpole. Can you explain what happened there? And you know, how we push back on stuff like that. That seems like that's just shooting ourselves in the foot. That's madness.
It is. And then more recently, another fire just down the road from that one, also in the Walpole Wilderness area in the Styx Forest, has set six different peat swamps on fire. You know, peat swamps should never, ever, ever be burnt. They're storing a massive volume of carbon, and they've formed over millennia, and they have these incredibly rare wetlands that have got plants in them that only live in those particular ecosystems. And then once they've been burnt like that, they're gone for good, and you lose 500 to 1,000 years of carbon accumulation in one fire event. So the local department and the federal department both acknowledge that you just need not to burn them, but because of the way that fire is conducted here by the Department of Biodiversity Conservation and Attractions from the air with helicopters over vast areas, means that it's more or less impossible for them to avoid those most fire-sensitive ecosystems and species. So it's absolutely routine for us to be seeing devastating impacts of fire. And the department has two performance measures that they report on every year in their annual reports, and that's a 200,000 hectare target per year. Doesn't matter what the ecosystems were, they just need to reach that arbitrary area target, and the cost per hectare. So you can see, you know, how a bureaucracy ends up mapping out a 15,000 hectare area and just burning it to smithereens from above. And, you know, that's unfortunately what we're seeing. There's some really good people in the department who know that this is wrong, but it's just like turning around the Titanic. It's been incredibly challenging watching all of the devastation, and then also just trying to get through to the department and to the minister and the premier about how important it is that it's changed.
Wow. What's the iceberg going to be then? How can we sink that ship? Or turn it?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to take a really long time. There's so much fear underneath it, which is a harder thing to address directly than money, I think. And in the meantime, what we need to be doing is protecting those most fire-sensitive places as quickly as we can. That's also the Tingle Forests and the granite outcrops and the ficifolia. And, you know, some of the species like the numbats and quokkas who are endangered, and we're still, you know, bombing out the last of their refuges.
Wow. And so these politicians that are behind this, I mean, whose back pocket are they in? What are some of the financial or political incentives at play here that is creating something as stupid as this?
Well, I don't think there's much financial going on with fire. It's more of a political risk sort of problem for government. I think there's an anxiety there that the community isn't sufficiently informed or mobilised, calling for change, and that if something goes wrong and the newspaper can point to this government, you know, the press is obviously very problematic, and say that it was because of a change to fire policy, even if it wasn't, then, you know, that presents a massive political risk to them. I think that's the problem that we face with fire. It's also very entrenched in the government agencies. We've had people there for decades arguing that it's the right approach and that it's not having significant negative impacts on the environment, and, you know, they've written many, many papers on the matter over the decades, and they've got a reputation now to protect. And even as some of those people start to recognise that it's become a problem, they're looking after themselves rather than the big picture.
Mm. And I know over here on the East Coast we've got that organisation Firestix, is it, which is like an Indigenous mob up this way who do kind of cultural burning. Well, they essentially just, you know, draw on 60,000 years of knowledge of country to carry out much more surgical backburning operations. Do you guys have something like that in the West? I mean, what are the solutions? What's a better way of doing things than just dropping napalm on 25,000 hectares of wilderness?
yeah, anything, right? Yes, there's similarly over here, 65,000 years plus of knowledge about how to manage country, including with fire, and increasingly more support and knowledge and more of a philosophical, at least, acceptance and effort to develop that kind of fire management. But it's, you know, what we're up against is that at the same time, DBCA are burning 200,000 hectares minimum a year. So, yeah, there has to be a marriage of one kind or another between those two approaches, and we're not seeing that yet.
Oh, mate, well, it sounds like people are going to be looking for work down there pretty soon when those bauxite mines and the timber industry gets shut down. So, yeah, just get them on the RFS out there backburning. You know,
yeah, go learn from some elders.
That's right. That comes first, obviously.
I think just something for me to latch onto and to easily pass on to other friends and people who may have an area have an interest in this area of conservation work. What can you leave me with to go tell those people? What is it that we should be speaking? What should we be saying to our surf communities, our coastal communities, our friends that inevitably have friends across the country, to the west, to the east, to the north and the south? How can we best support your work and support the communities over there in these affected areas?
Yeah, it's a big one, isn't it? You know, there's a big picture and a smaller picture, and I guess the smaller picture is that we've just seen all of us, we've seen places that we love be degraded, you know, even if it's only over the last decade or the last two decades. And I think we all need to draw that into focus and think about what we're leaving behind and what role we can play to leave behind something that's more hopeful and better, more sustainable, more healthy for the next generation. And we've all got a role to play in that one way or another. So it's about, you know, saying how do I give myself hope? Where do I look to increase my level of hope and my level of optimism so that I can participate and commit to making at least some small contribution? And if that contribution is around what I've been talking about, then following us on socials and having a look on our website and also our new website, endforestmining.org.au. We've just put that one up and we're developing that really quickly. You know, we'd be very grateful for everybody's support.
That's great. What about also, I have a bit of a selfish interest in this. We live rurally, sort of near the Byron Ballina area, and the Richmond River here is a pretty sick, well, it is a very ill river, and we have a lot of industrial agricultural practices that border the river. And I know there's a lot of people in our region that are looking to crack the code on how to replant streams, replant bordering areas to any water course in order to stop the acid sulfate levels leaching into the streams and the creeks and then choking out the rivers. And then, of course, you have all the pesticide and herbicide fertilizer issues with that industrial ag. Where can we look to find inspiration from what you were speaking about before when you were talking about working with farmers and planting out those sort of spaces?
You know, I'd be surprised if there isn't someone awesome around there already who's done some of this thinking, and you might already know who they are, or, you know, maybe one of your listeners does. But the catchment councils and the local shires and the local friends of groups and the weeding groups and the Noongar over there, First Nations groups, are likely to have people who've done some of that thinking, and there might be some plans and some capacity to rebuild something if it was dreamt up 10 years ago and then they couldn't find the capacity to keep it alive. Maybe it's going to the local shire meeting the next time the local government is having a meeting and raising it, asking the local councillors who they know and what they can do to support you to bring some ideas up and put together a round table, find the experts in your local area who you can get together to talk about it. Because I generally, you know, someone somewhere is the local expert and has done some thinking on this and is so hungry for somebody to ask them that question in their own patch, and then they'll offer you all this wisdom and thinking that they've already done.
Yeah, great.
Mate, that is such amazing practical advice. And before we leave you, Jess, like, it'd be good to acknowledge some of the big wins you guys have had too. Like, you've got runs on the board here. You know, you've been in this game for a while. Can you talk us through some of the successes that your organisation has had?
Well, we've been around since 1990 and we've, you know, just been trying to chunk off as much as we can and then keep looking to the future of what we can achieve next. The biggest ones we've had were in 2001 with the promise to end old growth logging when we protected 230,000 hectares of the best of what was left of the forest, which was pretty amazing. And then just now with the Premier promising to end native forest logging, the important part of that was promising to protect an additional 400,000 hectares, so massive, massive area. And then shortly after that, Rio Tinto came into our patch and put in an exploration application for over 107,000 hectares of old growth and other Jarrah forests around Dwelling Up and Jarrahdale between Perth and Bunbury. And incredibly, within about a year, we managed to turn them around and get them out of the state, which we were just so jubilant about. So, yeah, some big important things. But, look, I'm a campaigner, so I'm just always looking for how we pack those away securely and then move on to the next fight.
Mate. Magic. Amazing. Thank you so much for your service, your time today. And yeah, congratulations on, you know, running a successful, many successful campaigns.
Oh, thanks so much. It's lovely to talk to you both.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jess.
All right, cheers.